for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Unlike many of their boomer parents, millennials are not changing the world through calls for revolution and political movements. But like the boomers, observers of this generation say millennials have made a loud entrance onto the national stage. So what does it mean to be a millennial? Here in the studio, David Burstein. He's author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. Hannah Seligson, journalist and author of Mission Adulthood. Roger Fierro, co-founder of the startup First Encounter Productions. And Paul Taylor, he's with the Pew Research Center. And throughout the hour, I invite you to be part of the program, whether you're part of the millennial generation or any other. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Hannah, I'll start with you. You've been writing about your generation. What is it that makes millennials so special?
Do we have the whole hour? They're so diverse. They're so innovative. They're entrepreneurial. And we're living through this time of seismic social and political changes. We've never had as much gender and racial diversity. And so for me, my thesis is that we're the next greatest generation. And I would love to hear from everyone else about
the next greatest generation.
Yes.
Tell me why you think that.
Because, and I think some of this polling actually comes from Pew, and this is something that I really just kind of hang on to here. We believe in interracial marriage. We don't turn our heads. Most people don't when they see a same-sex couple walking down the street. And I think that kind of tolerance makes us a really noteworthy historical generation.
That's very interesting. Roger Fierro, you're co-founder of the startup First Counter Productions, and you're also featured in Hannah's book. Mm-hmm. Tell me your reaction. What is it about millennials that we as perhaps older adults ought to take note of?
I think that there should be special attention paid to what we're reacting against, right? There's a lot of things that peg millennials as whiny or lazy or entitled. And instead of kind of thinking about why that is, and it's instead seen as a negative thing. And I think that one of the things that I love about this panel is that it seems like everybody has a positive approach to what a millennial is. I feel like most of the things that I've read have been negative or critical.
Like what?
I don't know. If you Google millennial and you read the New York Times or any publication, I think at some point there has been a shift. And I think what Hannah and David have written are really good examples of that. And the stuff that Pew does is really cool, too. That quiz is amazing.
And let me turn now to David Burstein, your author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. You're also the founder of the Youth Voter Engagement Organization, Generation 18. How is the millennial generation shaping our world?
Well, when you look at it, you know, there's never been a generation that's had such a transformative impact on all other generations. You know, if you look at the impact that this generation is having on the way we all communicate, I mean, this generation, through creating new technology companies and new platforms, is shifting the way that you, Diane, have to do your show, and that you now have to tell everyone to go on Twitter and Facebook and to be part of the show. That's a direct impact of businesses started by people in this generation. And if you look at the way that these platforms and this way of communicating comes naturally to this generation, you need only look at the Arab Spring and see what happened. There were lots of disaffected people all over the Middle East of all generations, and it was young people who understood the power, the transformative power of, you know, being young and being in this time period who were able to take advantage of that, take advantage of the ability to scale that other generations weren't.
And to you, Paul Taylor, given that access or creation of new communication media, how does that change the outlook not only for millennials themselves, but for the rest of us, you and me, for example?
I think it's enormously empowering. The millennial generation is the first generation of digital natives. These new communication technologies with which people like you and I, we still have our jaws
We're
dropped.
We're catching up.
We have, it just astounds us that you can hold in your hand, you know, you click a few buttons and all the accumulated knowledge of the world is at your fingertips. For this generation, of course, it's the only world they've ever known, and they are able to adapt to it and take it to places that the rest of us will be chasing them.
So that
is enormously empowering. But there is another side to the millennial story. I agree completely that they are a very, very consequential generation, although just getting started. But they are just getting started in a very difficult economic climate. They have been dealt a very hard hand. Probably the worst hand of any coming-of-age generation since the Great Depression. And how that plays out in the course of our lives is a story yet to be written. One, I am impressed, as somebody looks at a lot of data, at how upbeat they have remained in the face of very tough economic times.
How do you account for that?
Well, I'll let my colleagues here who are of that, I can tell you the numbers. You know, and the numbers are that if you ask somebody in his or her 20s, you know, you now have the life you want economically. They will say no, of course not, because 40 or 50% of them are not even in the workforce. A lot of them are still living with mom and dad. They've delayed they've delayed parenting. They've delayed adulthood. They've delayed marriage. They are in a very slow walk to adulthood, and that's very much, I think, related to their economic circumstances. Has it bummed them out? No, I don't think so, looking at my data. Is it just because they're young and they don't know any better? Maybe. Or is it something about who they are and how they have come of age? And I would say that the empowering force of digital communication, they can put themselves at the center of the universe. 50 years ago, if you took a funny picture of your cat, you maybe showed it to your sister, and that was about it. Now if it's a good one, 100 people might see it, or a million people might see it, and there is something about that that I think has influenced the collective, personality of this generation.
But, Paul, I would say that we're not on a slower walk to adulthood. I'd say we are reimagining adulthood, and the economics of this play in...
What do you mean, reimagining?
And the economics of this play in enormously. I think we're in this moment of reinventing the American dream, because the American dream of a house in the suburbs and 2.2 kids and a car is, quite frankly, just not attainable for a lot of people. So I think, and this came up when I was doing interviews for my book, Mission Adulthood, that people are rethinking, what does it mean to be an adult? And maybe it doesn't mean having a house in the suburbs. Maybe it means having a smaller apartment. Maybe we're picking having job satisfaction over job security and deferring earning potential. And so I think that given the economic hand we've been dealt, which is really horrific, we are thinking about how to do the best with the worst hand. And that means that we have to have different markers of what it means to be an adult. I think we will have fewer kids, we'll delay marriage, and I think we will downsize our lives significantly.
I mean, I think it's important when you think about, people say this generation has this sort of terrible economic outlook. It's important to remember that a lot of that is based on the standard costs of living, which include home ownership and car ownership and all these costs associated. And right now we have the lowest, as Santa said, sort of the lowest rates of all of those things that we've seen for any youth demographic in history. So I think it's a question of how we look at what long-term economic future means is actually being changed.
But, I keep hearing about college debt and what you come out of college with and how that's going to affect your ability to move forward, Roger.
That's a really good place for me to jump in, huh? That's as much as it's cheaper to buy a house or that it seems to be a good environment to buy, right? There was something interesting that happened with the housing crisis. It was somewhat of a charade, right? There were lots of foreclosures because people couldn't keep up with their payments because something funny happened with banks. I think the same thing happened with student loans at some point, and I think that I was one of those that was duped. I was admitted into the University of Illinois, which is kind of like the big state school in Illinois. A lot of kids from my high school went there. But I wanted something a little bit different. I knew that I needed to make leaps and bounds in order to get out of the situation, you know, kind of like a working class urban environment. That I took on about $100,000 in student loans to go to the University of Chicago. And I grew up thinking, and I grew up reading, that if you went to a great school, you would make a lot of money and you'd be a great person. And when I graduated, I found that that wasn't necessarily guaranteed.
And of course, you've heard the statement from many people that there are no guarantees in this life. Mm-hmm. You did make that decision to take on that debt, knowing that at some point you were going to have to pay it back. But you assumed that the opportunity would be there for you immediately after you got out of school.
It wasn't so much immediately. I think it was more that we didn't really know what it looked like. We didn't really know what the effect of the recession was going to have. We didn't really know that maybe
there wouldn't be a job.
There wouldn't be a job and that, yeah.
And that it was going to be tough. And that is Roger Fierro. He's co-founder of the startup First Encounter Productions. He is featured in Hannah Seligson's book, Mission Adulthood. Short break here and right back. And welcome back. We're talking about a subject that an awful lot of people are interested in right now because the word millennial has come more and more to the fore. People are trying to understand exactly who and what the millennials are. Here in the studio, David Burstein. He's author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. Hannah Seligson is a journalist and author of Mission Adulthood. She writes frequently about millennials. Roger Fierro is co-founder of the startup First Encounter Productions. He's featured in Hannah's book. And Paul Taylor is executive vice president of the Pew Research Center. He also serves as director of the Center's Social and Demographic Trends Project. Coming to you, David Burstein, before the break, we were talking about Roger's $100,000 debt coming out of college. An awful lot of people have experienced college and university debt. I mean, my husband came out of law school 50 years ago with college debt, which he managed to pay off after several years in the workplace. The difference being now, I gather, we know more about it. It's gotten larger, and there are no jobs out there.
Right, and there are more people going to college. I mean, this is the most educated generation in history, so it's no longer just a problem that's facing a small group of people. It's facing, you know, an entire generation. I think, you know, there's a huge burden on this generation in that regard. But I also think on the flip side of that, you know, you see people like Roger who, in spite of facing that debt, are still going out and starting, you know, something that he's incredibly passionate about, which is a, you know, production company to do something to have an impact on the world. So I think that that's sort of the upside of it, which is this sense that ultimately in the long run, as Paul alluded to, we have this belief, this optimism that it will work itself out. We will pay those loans off. But it's certainly a daunting prospect when you're starting out.
And I also just wanted to say, I mean, Roger did turn down a full scholarship at the University of Illinois. And what came out when we really dissected that decision, which I think sort of gets lost in the whole college debt debate, is that he grew up in a working class family. He's the first person out of 40 cousins to go to college. And he wanted to leapfrog his social class. And he felt, and I think probably rightfully so, that going to a school as prestigious as the University of Chicago was a way to do that. And so I think that sometimes you do have to pay for those opportunities.
Paul, is that still the case?
Oh, it's still the case. We did a report last year called Is College Worth It? And it looked at all of these attitudes towards the albatross of student loan debt. And lots of families and young adults experience this very profoundly. It's among the most important things in their financial lives. On the other hand, what you also find is that the only thing more expensive than going to college is not going to college. That over the course of your lifetime, you can figure this different ways. We calculated that somewhere you get somewhere between a $500,000 to $1 million economic advantage for having gone to college, even factoring in the lost wages while you're in college and the student loans. So it is a good investment. But it is a difficult investment when you come out and there's nothing there
exactly.
for you.
Exactly. Paul, give us some of the stats. The millennials, I guess, between 18 and 31 years of age,
right.
How do they divide racially, ethnically?
Well, that's part of the transformation, and they are much more non-white than older generations. And if you look at their younger brothers and sisters, it becomes more and more non-white. So we are in a path as a country. If you go to the middle of the 20th century, we were 88% white. By the middle of this century, we'll be 46% white. The millennials are part of that transformation. Mm. They express themselves politically. In ways, whether it's with the immigration debate now, but it's whether it's a whole set of attitudes that are much more liberal
accepting.
And much more accepting. And so the racial change that I think for older adults, it's a lot of change pretty quickly, and there's some discomfort around it. The younger adults, it's who they are. It's the most natural thing in the world. So as Hannah was saying earlier, interracial marriage, about one, you know, when Barack Obama's parents were married in 1961 in Hawaii, we estimate that about one marriage in 1,000 was an interracial marriage. It was still illegal in many parts of the country. Today, about one marriage in six is an interracial or interethnic marriage. And what seemed just over the top and was a taboo and a stigma is now increasingly just part of who we are, and it's the millennial generation who make it part of who we are.
Roger, tell us a little about your family, how you grew up, what your aspirations were for yourself, and what your parents' aspirations were for you.
The aspirations that my parents had for me were to live in Chicago and be a city worker. You know, civil servants are pretty much most of the people in the city do. My mom worked for Chicago Public Schools. My dad was a union carpenter. They came here illegally in the 70s.
From
Mexico. And so, you know, they both naturalized at some point. My dad during the amnesty, my mom in 96. But I feel that my grandfather always told me that they struggled because they struggled so that we wouldn't have calluses on our hands, right? So the idea is that I was supposed to do a job that didn't involve manual labor or that was, you know, kind of, I guess, maybe blue collar. The aspirations that I had with myself didn't really match with what was available around me. And I mentioned this a little bit to David earlier, that my aspirations came from fiction, from television, from books, from things that I saw, you know, on TV, which was my window to the world then, because I wasn't a street kid. I was a nerdy kid that stayed inside and read. And so when I found out that I didn't know that I was underprivileged growing up until, like, I started the college application process. And I said, I can use this to my advantage, and I should actually try to do something that isn't in the, you know, in within the realm of what I imagine now. So I'm going to push myself. Worked really hard in college to get into the best school that I could. I did. I worked hard. And, you know, and I think that the debt that I have really informed what kinds of work I did. I'm kind of a Jane Addams social do-gooder type, and that didn't match up with making lots of money. But I found that in the vein of these of the American entrepreneurial spirit, which is now called startup, that's what I'm trying to do now, so that I don't have to pay work an office job until I'm 50, and maybe I'll pay it off by the time I'm 80.
Tell me about First Encounter Productions.
First Encounter is a really fun story. I reconnected with my roommate from college, freshman year, who's actually a DC boy. About a year and a half ago, when I was leaving teaching, and I was starting kind of to try new consulting for small businesses and doing kind of like a job juggling thing. Ben called me and asked me if I wanted to shoot him some ideas for reality TV shows. He was meeting with the producer. So that was kind of the first part of us working together. A year later, he kind of moved to Chicago temporarily, and now we started working together since maybe November, October. And what we want to do is to kind of merge activism, education, and entertainment. So the idea being that if I hadn't read certain books or if I hadn't watched certain shows, I wouldn't know what New York looked like or what New York culture was like, and I wouldn't want to go there. Or if I hadn't seen people going to college on Felicity, I wouldn't have even imagined what that would be like to move away, you know.
So the ideas that flow, Hannah, from these millennials, if we can call you all that, are sort of adventurous, are experimental, are outside the box that's already been laid out there for all of you.
Yes, and I'm sure David can speak more to this, but we mean just the rise of entrepreneurship. And I think that this is what happens, and you see sort of a historical pattern. When the financial rug is pulled out from under any generation, you are forced to innovate. And maybe it's sad that that is what has to happen as a result of sort of such terrible economic times. But I think it what I see, I think, and it bears out in the data and in my own reporting, that you are seeing people reimagine their careers. You know, now it's so that people have 8 jobs before they turn 30. You see more and more people, the aspiration is not to, you know, necessarily become a partner of Goldman Sachs or to, you know, work at a law firm. It's to, as Roger's doing and as so many other people, to start your own company. But I will just say one other thing, that I think the big divide in this generation between the haves and the have-nots is whether you have student debt, and that is unconscionable. That is just something that we should all, and I hope every lawmaker in Washington is listening to this, it is a true scandal.
Well, you know, I mean, I can't agree more with that, and I think that there needs to be more attention to student debt, and I think that the only reason that anyone is talking about it in the political arena, the few people that are, is because of the role this generation played in the last election and the last several elections in turning out and showing that we have political power and political muscle.
But, you know, at the same time, there are lots of people listening who may say to themselves that millennials simply feel as though they're entitled. And, you know, they're sort of unwilling to grow up.
It's interesting because I get that feedback a lot. And I think when you think about the way that this generation was raised and the culture that we were raised in, it was one where everything in our society, everything our parents told us, everything adults told us was that we were going to have all these great opportunities. We grew up in a prosperous economic climate for the most part in the 90s, which said, you know, you're going to go out and have these great opportunities. You should go out and have this great impact. And then we are hit with a reality that doesn't allow us to do that. I would not consider that as entitled. It's not entitlement when someone makes a promise to you and then as a society fails to live up to the promise of what they told you your world was going to be like. And I think in a lot of ways, this generation feels like they were promised something that then the rest of, you know, adults in this society, you know, got carried away with what happened in the financial crisis and didn't keep sort of the promises that they made to this generation.
We've got to David Burstein. He's the author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Hannah, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could also talk sort of meat and potatoes here, too, that our grandparents, I think many of our grandparents probably went to college on the GI Bill.
True.
And, I mean, I don't think it's entitled to think that we want to live in a society where someone doesn't have to be saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. If you look at the proportional spending of military spending versus what we invest in young people, it is will boggle your mind. I don't know if it's $77 billion on military spending and $1 billion on young people. I mean, we don't invest in young people. And for young people to want that and to want our society to take care of it, that is not entitled. That is basic respect.
Paul Taylor.
Well, you know, one of the perspectives on whether or not this is an entitled generation, and people, psychologists who look at personality attributes have suggested that there is some level of narcissism in this generation that's higher than previous generations. If I were to locate a proximate cause of that, I think I might go to the parenting styles of this generation. There's been a lot of literature on this generation was raised as a pretty coddled generation. The everybody gets a trophy generation, and part of that is loving parents. Part of that is perhaps having fewer children than people had in the past. Part of that is living in dangerous times, whether concerns about crime, whether concerns about terrorism, and all the rest. So I think it's a generalization, but it is fair to say that this generation was raised to be, and told by their parents, their teachers, their coaches, you are special, you can do anything. Now, parents do that all the time, but I suspect there was more of that in this generation. I think then the message of the empowering technology, which you can place yourself, you can publish to the world. This is a breathtaking change in human experience, and all of which sends messages, I am very special. And then along comes the harsh reality I took out that big loan because the future is going to be all mine. And then you crash into a world where you can't find a job, or you get an internship, or you're back home in your childhood bedroom, or you have four roommates. But the good news is, and we're listening to these other guests, is that the world of this generation has not come crashing down, and they have not sort of checked out and said it's all been a big lie. They are innovating, and they are bringing the energy, you know, that is going to change us, and my guess is change us for the better.
On the other hand, Hannah, you recently wrote an article about people in their 20s stuck in what you called the internship vortex. Talk about that.
Yeah, I wrote a piece in the Washingtonian about perma-terns, and these are people, because we have a very padlocked job market and you have environmental NGOs that get 900 applicants for an internship that doesn't pay you anything, that you have these sort of perpetual interns. And what I sort of take away from all these different points is that it feels like the system is rigged against our generation, and that it is that the ladder to social mobility is only for the privileged and for the rich now. And that is my biggest fear for this generation, is that the American dream will be, even if we are redefining it, will only be attainable if your parents can pay for college.
David?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that I'd actually slightly disagree with that and say that, you know, I talked to a guy, for instance, for the book who was a guy from Brooklyn, and he sort of had this experience, didn't go to college, didn't have any, you know, but he said because he has a computer, because he has the internet, he's able to design T-shirts and, you know, he's been able to start a business around doing that. So I actually think in some ways the connectivity has created new possibilities for people because, you know, smartphone penetration and internet penetration is actually greater and higher in, you know, in low-income communities than it is in some other communities. So I think that that sense of access and connectivity has really helped connect people who otherwise may have had no way out and no way out of opportunities. Not to say that there aren't a lot of challenges still in those communities, but I think there's actually a lot of new possibility. One of the greatest uses of public libraries is now to connect to the internet, for instance.
Except that public libraries themselves are being underfunded and failing. David Burstein, Hannah Seligson, Roger Fierro, they're all part of the millennial generation. Paul Taylor and I are in a different group. We'll take a short break now, and when we come back, we'll take your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Blanco, who read his poem One Today at President Obama's second inauguration last month. Blanco is the fifth and the youngest of America's inaugural poets. He's also the first Latino. His parents emigrated from Cuba, and the first openly gay writer chosen for the role. Join us.
Welcome back. As we talk about the rising generation of millennials, those between the ages of about 18 and 31, during the break we were talking about 9/11 and Columbine. David.
You know, I think one of the interesting things about this generation is you've seen us go through these sort of series of these terrible events in our formative years. And, you know, things like 9/11, things like Columbine that took place at a time when we were just, you know, figuring out who we were. We were going out of middle school into high school. We were going out of high school into college. We were having these important moments figuring out who our identity was. And that was all very much wrapped up in those experiences. Two wars that went on for the majority of our lives that were fought overwhelmingly by people in this generation and our peers. And I think when you go through those kind of experiences, you know, one approach could be a generation of people who's afraid and scared and doesn't, you know, thinks the world is full of danger and uncertainty, which I think we have seen some people responding to that way in other generations with some of the rise of survivalism and things that we've seen even more recently. But instead, this generation has said, we realize that we're part of a global interdependent world. We realize that the world has problems and we want to do something about them. And we've become resilient and we are able to bounce back from these challenges. I think it's one of the reasons we're able to bounce back from this economic crisis and one of the reasons we are so socially minded.
All right, let's take a caller in. Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Matthew.
Hello, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
So I guess my comment was is that the millennials, we have also been a very tracked and tiered generation, and the top tier of our generation has gone to great schools but are now located in maybe five or six cities in this country and are trying to make it in D.C. or San Francisco. And when you get outside of that top tier, it is not a rosy picture. These kids do not have jobs that have been consistent. They don't have great long-term employment concepts. And it's a much different world outside of that top tier in the millennial generation.
You know, I have a Twitter to that same topic. It says, it's obvious to me that Diane only has the New York City / urban millennials represented today, speaking as though they represent everyone their age. Big differences, Hannah.
Yeah, and I think this is another sort of divide in the generation. There is a huge number, and I think that statistically they're called treaders, people who don't have a college degree, who are much more economically disadvantaged, even the people who have loans. And I think we need to caveat this whole conversation with that important point.
All right, and here's another email on millennials from Leslie. She says, how and why do millennials respond differently to difficult economic times in adulthood than those emerging into adulthood during or just after the Great Depression? Paul?
Not sure I can answer that question. The Great Depression generation, as it came of age, was a great believer in government and in civic institutions
and in
absolutely hard work. And I'm not sure that the millennials aren't also great believers in hard work, but
different kinds.
What that generation saw with the Depression and then World War II, they saw government as an agent for good in their own lives and in the world. And today, I think one big difference is we don't see government in those exalted terms, we don't necessarily see collective action in those terms. So there's a little bit more of you're in it for yourself, and you've got to be savvy, and you've got to be smart, and you've got to figure it out. And again, empowered by these communication tools that give you the opportunity to do some of those things.
I would also just add that I think one thing that's different, you know, in my book, Fast Future, one of the reasons I called the book Fast Future is because the world that this generation is living in has seen so many of these simultaneous revolutions in every different sector of our economy and our world at the same time, that the idea of, you know, what things might look like a year from now, we have a sense that, okay, in a year we could be out of this. This could look totally different. And I think people in the Great Depression time period had no sense of feeling like, oh, in a year this could all be better, in a few days this could all change, because there was no sense of that sort of constant revolution and that constant change in how things were moving.
But I also think too, and this sort of goes, I have a less sort of rosy picture than you do, David, of the two wars and the legacy that it's had on our generation. I profiled a young woman who had to buy her body armor off the internet because Congress didn't fund that, and I think that speaks to a larger point about the sort of lack of safety net that our generation has, that has cultivated this kind of Ayn Randish rugged individualism, is it incumbent on the families and the individuals to help raise up young people? And that is a huge burden. And I think that, as you pointed out, Paul, there's not as much trust and faith in government. And I think that's a shame.
All right. To Sylvia in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for having me
on. Sure.
There's so much that I could say. I'm actually finding myself right in between Gen X and the millennials. I was born in December of 1980, so I kind of have transitioned these two groups of people, and I was amazed as I was in college, just the vast change that all of a sudden happened to our campus when this whole group of really bright, talented young people came, you know, came onto the scene. And I would like to echo Paul's comments about how it really, there was a dramatic shift in parenting. My parents were actually born before the baby boomers, during the Depression and during World War II. And there's just a completely different approach. I really found my classmates and subsequently people that I've worked with and have supervised not necessarily believing in challenges, almost like rules don't necessarily apply, often not willing to take one for the team, a very different group perspective. But at the same time, I've seen that that's just a ginormous strength, because I don't see that this challenge applies to me. I'm going to overcome it. I'm going to, you know, start my own business. I'm going to start a nonprofit. I'm going to do all these things. But at the same time, it is stressful. You know, it is really hard to supervise somebody who doesn't think that everybody needs to come in at the same time.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's interesting because this generation is redefining what they want employers to do and how they want work to look like. And I think it's something, you know, one of the number one questions that human resources recruiters get when they're interviewing millennials is, you know, how flexible are your hours? Can I work from home? You know, what's your policy on what devices I can bring? What's your policy on volunteerism? What's your commitment to social responsibility? I mean, these are questions that that recruiters have not had to deal with, specifically not as the first questions they've been asked in a long time.
Let's talk about marriage for a minute. What do you find in terms of how many want to commit themselves to marriage, Hannah?
Well, I'm married, and I like being married. But I think what you're finding in this generation is that it is the college-educated cohort that is keeping the institution of marriage alive. And again, there is this big class divide, and another, as I'm sure Paul can delineate the numbers here, and that's what's happening. But young people still very much want to reach that sort of traditional milestone of adulthood. They want to get married. They want to have kids, probably fewer, because it's so expensive to have kids, and childcare is another big boondoggle. So, we're pro-marriage generation, and even more so even within the same-sex couples, which Roger can speak to.
Paul.
Well, if you look at the numbers, you're not a pro-marriage generation. Something like 20% of people in their 20s today are married. In my day,
yeah.
That was about 60%. So marriage is happening much later, and it is absolutely tied to the economic circumstances, and it becomes self-perpetuating. Hannah, you're absolutely right. Most young adults want to get married, but increasingly they don't. And that's happening at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale because they feel they don't, quote, qualify. They are not marriage material yet because they don't have a job and they don't have a career, and they associate getting married with having financial stability and security. Unfortunately, this becomes a reinforcing cycle because marriage through human history has been in economic institutions. To put it two can live more cheaply than one, and it works. It works as an economic institution, and if you don't participate in or partake in it, you don't get there, and you just sort of get into a negative cycle. And I do think that there's an economic divide that is very much associated with the marriage divide.
Paul Taylor of the Pew Research Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, let's go to Tampa, Florida. Cordell, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I'm going to be quick here. I'm just making a comment. I'm an African-American. You know, my mom was a single mother. She was a Head Start teacher, made $30,000 a year. I live in Tampa. It's in the South. It's the most racist. Well, I wouldn't say the most racist, but it is a very racist city. I went to a state college. I only have $30,000 in debt. And when I went out of college and all my millennial peers were out occupying Wall Street, I got a temp job at Citigroup. And now I make $60,000 to $70,000 a year. I don't understand why millennials have this sense of entitlement that, actually, no, I do understand it. You know, it comes from what you guys talked about with the parenting and, you know, the internet and sitting on these mountains of stuff like Facebook and MySpace and Twitter, where you can say, oh, look at me, look at these accomplishments that I've done. And people feel like if they don't find a job on Google or if they don't find a job immediately, they, you know, they'll give up immediately. Just like with doing like a research paper, you know, we had the ability to just go to Wikipedia and copy it off of there versus people from older generations that actually had to physically go into a library. And I also feel like millennials are very disconnected from each other. They're willing to ignore text messages. They're willing to break off plans with each other at the whim of the hat. They're able to filter each other off because of things like caller ID. And I just feel like my generation does have a sense of entitlement. I don't think they are willing to put the nose to the grind. My first job out of college, I had to take the bus here in Tampa, and that takes 45 minutes. I know millennials that will just quit a job immediately because, oh, I'm tired. I don't feel like showing up to my job at Starbucks. Well, I don't feel like having an office job because that's not for me. And I really think my generation does have a sense of entitlement problem. I don't think that it has anything to do with our parents. I think we need to grow up, and part of growing up is to realize that, hey, not all promises people make come true.
All right. And Cordell has certainly a different view.
Yeah,
Roger.
I think there's some truth in what he's saying, but I think Hannah mentioned in her book that only 7% of people under 30 work for Fortune 500 companies. And for some reason made me really excited and upset. and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, one, there's a part that, you know, we want to imagine that millennials are being kept out of these, you know, traditional workplaces because they might not fit the mold, or they might want to like be on Facebook while they're working. But I think that instead they've become creative about what kind of income they want to generate or how they're generating that income. Right? It's kind of what we're talking about, kind of making, you know, making it on your own path. And I think that he might be happy working at Citibank, but, you know, I don't think I would be.
But at the same time, he makes some other points, which are, for example, that millennials won't put up with the smallest bit of dissatisfaction or inconvenience. Is that a fair point, Hannah?
I mean, I think everyone has some story of some millennial who brought their mother on a job interview or who quit after there wasn't the right type of coffee in the machine. I mean, we all have that story. I think the bigger issue...
Are they true?
Everyone has one story. I'm not going to say I think that there are pockets of it. But I think that we have unfairly gotten the rap as an entitled generation. And I think the bigger question is, how do we level the playing field? You know, Obama talked about not having the system rigged. And I truly believe the system is rigged against this generation. And I think we need to think about not thinking about, oh, bemoaning that we're so entitled. How do we give everyone in this generation an opportunity to succeed?
Where do you see yourself in 10 years, Hannah?
Well, I hope to have a job at the New York Times if it still exists.
Roger, where do you see yourself 10 years hence?
I think I could get married in Illinois after maybe a month or so. I think that gay marriage just passed in the Senate and it's waiting to go to the House. So I'll probably be married with like a kid, maybe like a book or five under my belt.
Good for you. And David, how about you?
Well, you know, I hope to have at least a few more books under my belt in the next 10 years. And I think I'd like to see myself, you know, having an ability to, you know, see some of the stuff that we're talking about, some of the challenges in this generation change. I'd like to play a role in making that change and some of the ways that, you know, we're talking about how this, the challenges this generation is facing.
So you feel very socially active, as though what you're doing really can help your generation.
Absolutely. And I'm a big believer in the power of storytelling to change, you know, how people perceive things. Because one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I felt like, you know, there were all these sort of messages being sent to this generation that, you know, as we talked about earlier. And I said, if no one's speaking up for this generation, if there's not sort of a voice saying, you know, this is what this generation is actually feeling, stop telling this generation, you know, what we are and what we aren't, and actually listen to people in this generation and what their perspective is. And I hope that's what people will find in the book, is that sense of, you know, hearing from the voices in this generation. I think that's the way that you change things, and that's the way you change the world.
Hannah, how about you? Do you feel as though you need to help people understand not only what it is you're going through now, but your hopes, your aspirations for the future, and how they may be different from, say, those of my generation?
Yeah, and I mean, it's sort of, I think Dave and I have a very similar story here. The reason I decided to write Mission Adulthood and follow a group of seven people, all of whom represent different demographics in the generation, was to sort of document these challenges, but also to tell a very positive, empowering story of how we are redefining it. And even if it doesn't look like how our parents and our grandparents grew up, it's not wrong, it's not bad, it's just different.
Hannah Zelick, she's journalist and author of Mission Adulthood. David Burstein is author of Fast and Future. Roger Fierro is co-founder of the startup First Encounter Productions. Paul Taylor is executive vice president of the Pew Research Center. Thank you all.
Thank you
for having me.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yorv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the